Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Marcia Sitkoski. I'm the co-chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum and your chair for this evening's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. Tonight, we'll be hearing from two fascinating farmers and authors, Joan Gasso, author of Growing Older, and Novella Carpenter, author of Farm City. You may or may not know, but they have some very similar experiences and also some contrasting experiences, West Coast, East Coast, urban, suburban, and so on. So it should be a really fascinating conversation. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Novella.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having us. This is such a delight. I didn't know Joan's work. I should introduce myself first. I'm Novella Carpenter, author of Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. I'm an urban farmer in Oakland, California, and I have a farm on an abandoned lot in kind of like downtown Oakland, but we sort of call it the ghetto. And there I raise rabbits and chickens and dairy goats and lots of vegetables. And I wrote a book about the experience, which is divided up into three parts, which is turkey, rabbit, pig. So sort of separated into chapters and sections of my development as an urban farmer. I'm so delighted to be here to interview Joan. She is an absolute treasure. And Michael Pollan, I studied with Michael Pollan at University of California, Berkeley, and he was always talking about Joan. And I finally got a copy of her book, This Organic Life. And I was like, wow, this is so, it's really similar to Farm City. It tells the story of a woman who's growing her own food. And yet her book was published in 2001. So, I'm just the offspring of Joan, basically. So I'm going to make you love her as much as I do. So, Joan, why don't you just introduce yourself really quickly, and then we'll start getting into the nitty-gritty of your book.
Okay, well, I can't introduce myself in such a lovely way as Novella does, so I'll just leave it to her, but I will tell you a little bit about what the book is about. The book is, by the way, called Growing, Older. There has to be a pause in there because it's meaningful, because it's about growing and it's about being older. This book, my book, the subtitle is Chronicle of Death, Life, and Vegetables. This book is divided into four sections. The first section is about the death of my husband and my astonished shock to find that I didn't miss him. I'd been married for 40 years in what I thought was a happy marriage. I always talk to my students about how happy my marriage was and how they should only be so lucky as me to have a 40-year marriage. And then 2 weeks after he died, I found myself skipping down the street. And so it took me years to try to figure out why. And I'm not going to tell you what I figured out because you have to read the book to find out. But so the first section is about that, and it also includes some things about some issues that have arisen for me over time about my own development and why I think that some of my confrontation with realities about the world prepared me not to be so upset about Alan's death. The second section is called What Next, and it's about some of the things that I do now that Alan's gone. And it contains the parts that will probably be most offensive to those who aren't offended by the idea that I could actually say I didn't miss my husband. But this has sections on travel and why we shouldn't do so much of it. And it has a rant on microliposuction in a chapter called Working Out, which is about how I work and I'm outdoors, you know. So that's my workout. And it also has a section called Things That Break and Things That Don't, which was my hope was that it would put Maytag out of business. Somebody told me that they thought they were out of business, but they're wrong. I went on the web and I checked, and they just had a major recall of dishwashers that catch on fire. So they're living up to their standards, in my view. The third section is called Some of the Other Species, and it's about some of the creatures that live in the world of my garden that I had interactions with in the wake of living alone. You know, that I wasn't alone. I was with all these other people. And then the last section is called Growing Older Without a Comma, and it's about getting older, and it includes a chapter called My Obituary, which I don't want you to be afraid to read. My friends were afraid to read it because they said, I don't want to read about your death. I said, it's not about my death. It's about the kind of obituary I'd like to have, you know, which is a funny one, you know. So that's it.
Okay, so you guys know what you're in for. I kill animals. She's glad her husband's dead. Okay. It's very jolly tonight. Okay, so let the questioning begin. Okay, so one of the things I did is Joan has a really nice blog and website, and so I went there and started reading her old work, because some of this stuff is like on microfilm. It's from the days before the internet, if you can imagine. And I read with glee a work that you wrote called The Modest
Proposal. Oh, that's my favorite old piece.
Okay, so, you know, sort of playing off the Jonathan Swift Let's Eat Babies. She's saying, let's eat. And when was that written? What was it, in the 80s?
70s, probably.
Okay. I know there was a thing about Ethiopia and the famine within there. It was like an ad or something.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I knew that it was a very old piece. Her modest proposal is that, gasp, upwardly mobile people start eating local food. I mean, you predicted the future. This is like exactly what has happened. So I'm wondering if you're feeling, well, you said it's one of your favorite pieces. I'm wondering how you're feeling about being able to predict the future. And then also, what do you think about the idea of, you know, the sort of elite idea that the only people who can afford to eat local food are actually the upwardly mobile?
Well, those are two really huge questions. I'm not sure that I predict the future, but I do find it, I wrote a book called The Feeding Web, which was published in 1978, which was sort of taken from the class I'd been teaching through the early 70s, and it was about limits to growth, food and population, food pollution, food supply, advertising, all the kinds of things that were, and energy and food. And when I go back and look at that now, it makes me very upset because it could have been published yesterday, you know, and nothing's happened. And one of the reviewers, I love this, when that book came out, it was reviewed in Food Technology, which you can imagine how they felt about it. And the reviewer was somebody I knew, was a terrible writer. I could tell it was him before I turned the page because he wrote so badly. But what he said was, well, unfortunately, many of the pieces come from as far back as 1975. Actually, one of them was Archie and Mehitable, and it came from 1937, I think. And he said, and many of the problems she identifies have been solved. And I thought, hello? What planet are you living on, sir? I don't know one of those problems that's been solved. So that's the answer. What was your second question?
Oh,
which was much harder?
No, that was good. The elite, the idea that, you know, the sort of elitism argument, because, I mean, for me, you know, I grow food and then I feed people that come in because I squat on the property where I live and I sort of like, come on in and let's eat.
Yeah,
but,
great.
You know, oftentimes the problem is that, you know, when you get into this kind of locavore activity, you get this kind of, well, I can afford to be a locavore because, you know, that the food tends to be more expensive if it's local.
It's something we all just have to fight against. I mean, the movement is still painfully small. I mean, we all move among people, or many of us move among people who are committed to this or have become committed to it, and we sort of think it's growing. But, you know, the last time I looked, there was still less than 1% of the cropland was organic. You know, so we're talking, it's still a small movement. And when you talk local, it's probably even smaller. Although I don't think everyone who's organic is certified, and so I think that's an undercount. And I think there are people like you and me growing food and giving it away, and that. But we really have to struggle against it. I'm part of a group in New York called Just Food. I'm on the board of directors, and we have helped start a number of CSAs, and when we first began, the whole idea was that there were all these people in the city who were hungry, and there were all these farmers right around the city who were going broke, and it didn't make any sense. So how could we somehow bring these people together? So we started CSAs. We've now helped start 100 CSAs, and after we had started the first maybe 15 or 20, or helped start them. I mean, we just gave support. The woman who started the group said, we're not doing any more until we can have people who are poor. This is all Upper West Side stuff in New York, or Upper East Side stuff. It's not for poor people. And so we were the ones who got the Department of Agriculture to accept food stamps for CSAs, which was our doing. And we found all kinds of ways getting community groups who would do the payment up front and then let the poor people pay by having staggered shares. But we felt people needed to pay, but they couldn't pay as much and they couldn't pay all at once. Mm-hmm. But it just has to be a continual struggle. We just can't settle down comfortably and read edible magazines and enjoy ourselves with all this delicious food. It is delicious, but we just can't do that because we live in a very unfair society that's getting more unfair by the moment, and we can't afford to just assume that it's fine for well-off people to eat better than the poor and go with that. You know, it just isn't fine at all. And the rest of that food supply is getting worse every minute. I mean, it's just disgusting. It's not food, you know. We have to get away from that.
Right. And, you know, my thing has always been sort of like, well, if you can afford it, you can buy it because you're working, obviously, a lot, and so you have money. And then for people like me, kind of scroungers, you can grow your own, you know, so it's like this best of both. You know, you can, DIY it. And I know that you do that. You grow this garden, this beautiful vegetable garden. So I wondered if you could describe your vegetable garden, and then I have some follow-up questions about when you started. You know, right now it's super. I don't know if you've had the chance to just sort of walk around San Francisco or Berkeley. You'll see everyone is growing, you know, some kind of lettuce or kale in their front yard now. It's very trendy.
Really?
It's very trendy. And I remember just only a few years ago, it was tacky. It was real tacky. Do you guys remember that? It was like, oh, God, what is she doing? She must be hungry. But, you know, now it's like sort of you take the moral high ground if you're growing kale in your front yard. So I'm wondering, you went through this time when you might have been considered tacky by your neighbors. Were you?
I keep thinking about your farm, Novella, and we want to talk about your farm, and because it's tacky, right? I mean, it's really tacky in a very profound way, and I love the idea. But, no, I didn't live – the first community we lived in where we started to garden, we did garden the front yard, really, but people were so pleased to see the place taken care of. We had a beautiful Victorian house, which we took care of, and because it was cheap, but we couldn't afford to take care of it, but we did, and – so I've never had that. No, the people who thought badly of me were the nutrition profession. Hmm. I was thought of as a very strange person that I thought anyone should learn anything about food and where it came from. I mean, my definition is that nutrition is about what happens after the swallow, and anything before the swallow doesn't count.
Wow.
Is irrelevant. And that's why, I mean, it's the only reason I'm a leader is because I said, no, that's not right, you know.
Yeah.
That's what happened. I came into this profession concerned about world hunger, and nobody was concerned. I mean, we had a world hunger crisis in 75, and somebody wrote to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition and said, there's the four horsemen of the apocalypse are out there, and I don't see anything in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that is in any reflects that in any way. And the editor wrote back and said, that isn't really our field. That's the field of the demographers and the agricultural economists and all those people. Those are the things they deal with. We're in the field of nutrition.
That makes no sense.
I
is
know,
it still
but the
like
trouble
that?
Is, it's. I'm afraid, in the deepest bowels of the nutrition field, it is. Mm-hmm. There's been shifting. There's been a subtle shifting, and you can actually say the word organic now without being thought of as a complete nut. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say that most people felt that. I mean, I know what goes on in colleges, and I don't think what most people feel that you have to learn about the food supply if you're a nutritionist. That what you're learning about is what happens after the swallow, what the interaction of the nutrients with the body, chemistry, and so forth and so on.
Wow. So they thought you were crazy. Yeah, you're growing your own food.
I have to. You're going to keep up these questions, so I have to. Well, I want, because there's things I want to know about you. Your book ends with you being sadly thinking that you're probably leaving the place.
Yeah.
Did you?
No, I didn't, and I'm glad you asked. because the great thing is, and I want to talk about what happened with your place, but because what happened was, okay, so if you guys haven't read Farm City, then I'm just going to ruin the ending for you. But it ends sort of with me. I had been squatting on the farm for a long time, and my neighborhood had started to become gentrified. This is back, remember when there was like an economic boom and people were like, I think I'm going to buy a shack for $500,000. I think I'm going to do that. So people were looking at my lot suddenly and salivating with like the development potential. even though it was in this dicey area. So the lot went up for sale. And someone did buy it. So at the end of the book, the lot, there's a for sale sign up, and it was knocked over by someone, I don't know who. and then it actually did sell. And I just sort of finished, when you're writing a book, you're like, where does it end? Perfect, all right, whatever. I don't know what's going to happen. I just, sent in the manuscript, and then it was published. So this was in 2007 when I finished the book. And then it was published in 2009, or I think I finished the book, around at the end of 2007. So the book's published in 2009, economic crisis, everything has hit the fan. The lady who bought it for a lot of money, and her name was Shirley. And I would see her every once in a while, she'd show up, and I'd be like, hey, what's going on, Shirley? And she would be like, yeah, I'm going to still build those condos. And I'd be like, okay, just let me know. Then I just continue farming, because what can you do? You can't stop after you've been doing it for so long. Then one day, this is recently in the last 2 months, Shirley came to me and she said, look, I need to get rid of this thing. This is like killing me, because she's paying taxes and liability, all these things. And I said, wow, that, okay. And this is when I have this scene, and it looks like when Jones Farm floods, that's kind of what I imagine the devastation, where it's like just shrapnel, just stuff is going to be flying everywhere and trees are going to be down and all this stuff. And Shirley said, I want to sell it to you. And I was convinced it was because last time I saw her, I gave her some flowers. I think that always helps. So note to self to do that again. But also because, and I said, well, Shirley, I'd love to. That would be great if I had any money. And she said, no, I'm going to make it really easy for you. I'm going to give it to you for this very super cheap price. And if you can't afford that, then I'll just you can just pay me, in installments. So nice of her. And immediately, at first I was like, Shirley, you stay here. I'm going to go get that money. I think Bill has that under the mattress somewhere. Then I was like, wait a minute. This is a trap. So anyway, but it wasn't. It was fine. It all turned out. And I own the lot now. So
Oh, that's great. Thanks.
Yeah, so my big fear was land developers, and Joan's big fear is the flood. So I want to know what happened with yours.
Before we continue, I just want to interrupt and remind our listening audience that this is a program by the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Novella Carpenter and Joan Gussow discussing their farming and life experiences.
Well, if anybody's read either of my books, this most recent one particularly, but my land is 36 feet wide. I'm on a city lot, basically, in a little village on the west bank of the Hudson River, and my land is right on the Hudson, and I have a boardwalk and the riverbank, which is 25 feet deep, and then it comes down two steps into my yard, which then goes back, and then goes back up where my house is. And on either side, it's also higher. So as you can see, that makes my yard a bathtub. And the fact is that the Hudson is not happy staying where it is all the time. And it sometimes comes very seriously to visit, and it crashes over the boardwalk. And when it crashes over the boardwalk, it brings in things like 2x4s and sheets, 4x8 sheets of plywood and other such things, which are hard on plants, I have to tell you, when they float in, Anyway, so we had floods from the time we first went there, and I think we should have known but that there wasn't incidental, that it was like chronic, and it was chronic. And 1 year I had 14 floods. And the thing is the water has to run in. It has to soak in. So it is wet for a long time. But amazingly enough, I've always been able to continue gardening. And it's hard on the gardener and it's hard on the plants, but I garden and I grow my own food. So this year, on the 14th of March, nature sent me a very forcible lesson for which I am deeply grateful. She said, Joan, you're not getting any younger. This is going to get worse. Greenhouse warming is real. The Hudson is going to rise probably 2 to 3 feet by the end of the century. You will be underwater all the time. And so she smashed my boardwalk. The boardwalk was lifted off its thing that broke. The pilings that hold it up were broken off. The boardwalk was thrown onto the riverbank. The fig tree was the rescuer. The fig tree held it from coming on into the yard. Mm-hmm. And all the raised beds, which I had put in wood, hoping that it would get it above the water, they were all torn up, even though they had rebar about a foot deep holding them down. They were all torn up and tossed in the middle of the path. I looked out in the morning, and I just said, well, it's radio. I'm not allowed to say what I said. But anyway, I said that. And I said, you know, repeating something you've done 35 times before is the definition of insanity. This cannot just go back to what had happened before. So I called a man who had helped me before by building those boxes, and he'd also built me a stone wall along the north side of my property, which was meant to keep the water from my neighbor's property from sloshing over into mine. And it did that, but it still didn't keep the water out. And I called him, and he came right down. This was a Sunday morning, bless him. And he stood there in my yard, and he looked at this disaster. There was water still very deep. And he said, Joan, the lot north of you is vacant. And I said, yeah, I know. They just tore down the house, a 100-year-old house, and the man was going to build a new house in April. This was March. He said, do you think I could get permission to open up the fence and bring in my bulldozer, my little
bobcat.
Bobcat. Yeah. And bring in dirt, have dirt loaded into the yard. And I said, yes, let's try. At the time, I have to tell you, I had this wonderful thing. It's going to all be fixed, I said. I'm not going to ever have to do this again. And then I realized that in order for that to happen, I had to take up like 100 pavers, thousands of bricks, hundreds of plants, all had to be taken out of the yard before I could load this dirt in, and I had maybe a week. So I began. A wonderful neighbor who I didn't know at all, who had looked over my fence 2 years earlier and said, if you ever want help in the garden, I want to learn to garden. I'd kept
Perfect.
His name.
Yeah.
And I called and I said, Jim, this is Joan Gusso. Do you remember who I am? Oh, yeah, sure, I remember. I said, I don't think this is quite what you had in mind. He came over for 3 or 4 days and put in 3 and 4 hours at a time and raised all the pavers and a lot of the bricks. He was just fantastic.
He was
a Wall Street person who worked from home, and he hated what he was doing. And so he was really happy to be out there doing this gut work. Anyway, it was all the stuff was taken up, and then it flooded again. That when it all got 2 weeks later was the full moon, and it flooded again. So we had to put off doing anything. And so finally it got dry enough that he could bring in his little bobcat, and the dirt started coming in. And it was really hard. I mean, there was a point when all this was up and all the plants were out and up in my driveway and up on my terrace and everywhere I could put them. And there was still the outline of the path, and I have a circle, and then it was all wiped out. And I looked out on this space that I had invested, I knew every inch of, you know, it was like, and it was gone. And that was really hard.
Yeah.
And that's the day I almost lost an erstwhile friend when she came up on the porch and I said something about, she said, how are you? I said, well, this has really been the worst day. And she said, oh, you can't let yourself. You know it'll be better than ever. And I wanted to kill her. I wanted to say, let me mourn, you know?
Yeah.
My heart's out there. That's,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
It's like somebody saying, oh, you lost your best friend. You'll get another one.
Yeah, you'll grow another one.
Exactly. So it's now the good news is that, you know, we thought the dirt came in. Dave moved it around. He leveled it. Somebody had given me 300 yards
wow.
of topsoil,
oh my
wonderful
God.
Topsoil from a famous farm was wow. brought in. And then everything got leveled and that we began to put the plants back. And then we had all the area where the beds were going to go, 10 beds on either side. And the people from Stone Barns and Blue Hill came over. 19 people came over and rebuilt my garden.
No way.
And it was really very, very touching.
Can I get their number? Because I want to...
Yeah.
That's amazing. God, that's such a good story.
So I've sowed my clover paths.
Wow. So it's much taller. The idea
it's
is
two
that
feet
it's,
up.
It's so now it won't flood as much.
Well, it will still flood. Mm. I mean, it will still... there's no way it's not going to keep sometimes coming over the boardwalk.
Right.
But it'll go back... I mean, it doesn't... It's going to run onto my neighbor's land.
Right, perfect.
And, you know... Not on mine. It's not going to stay. That was always the problem.
Yeah.
It was so wet.
Right, right. Oh, that's amazing. Wow, but you had to destroy it in order to save it.
So my next book's called Starting Over at 81.
Oh, I love that. That's so wonderful.
So now,
yeah.
So you're in the same place.
Yes, yeah, so
are
I'm
you
in the same place. But,
planning
you know,
to raise any more hogs?
No. I'm not going to raise any more pigs. My thing is that, you know, now that I'm a you know, proper landed gentry property owner,
right.
I've lost my renegade status, first of all, so I mourn that. And then the other thing is that, you know, I've been farming on concrete. So my entire lot is a big
That's
concrete
right.
pad. And what I've done is just build soil over it.
This lot that you now own is the one that was all concrete.
Yeah.
So are you going to do something about
well,
that?
Well, that's why that's why I know what a bobcat is that I'm going to have a dude show up with a bobcat, and we're going to slowly... But I have to do the same exact thing, which is destroy it. And I actually had him... And the problem is, you know, I live in California. It's like year-round gardening. So, like, right now, you should come over. My garden looks great. I have broccoli and huge fava beans, and it looks wonderful. And then I'm imagining, like, destroying this so this guy can come in with his bobcat. It's almost worse than, you know, it's like I'm going to be the developer, you know, but I'm just going to get rid of the concrete, and then I'll be able to, like, you know, be in touch with the sweet earth finally.
But you know what, Novella? The great thing about being a vegetable gardener is that it's an annual crop.
Yeah.
And so you always start over.
Yeah.
So,
no,
you know,
you're right.
It'll be there. My garden is all back, and I fed myself from, you know, I'm feeding myself from my own garden this year, even though this whole horrible thing happened.
Right. I know. I just
it
have
all
to remember
comes
that.
Back.
Okay. I don't want to kill you either. See, I feel good about this. I have bees out there, too, though. That's like, they're not going to like the bobcat very much. I'm sure comedy will result from that. So that's my deal. But I'm not going to ever raise hogs again. I raise these pigs off dumpster scraps because I figured, you know, part of, like, people are like, why, Novella? Why in the city? You're crazy. Go to the country and go to your people there. Thing is, I don't like people that much in the country. And they don't like me somehow. But also, the city is so great because there's so much waste, you know? I mean, in this horrible irony, paradox, you know, of restaurants producing all these, you know, scraps and, you know, organic grocery stores just throwing away huge wheels of brie, for instance. And, you know, I can only eat so much brie. So that's why we decided we would raise the pigs to sort of, like, do that. But now you said you've harbored chickens before. Remember
no,
that
I never had.
Well,
our kids, when we lived where we lived before, which is about 5 miles north of where we are now, we got bantams for our kids.
Oh, okay.
But
bantams
we found
are small
that
chickens.
In the suburbs with dogs, if you put them in a pen, we didn't realize how we would have to armor the pen. We let them fly around, and they were safe then, and they could roost in trees and things.
Mm-hmm.
But they like to lay their eggs off the edge of the porch, which was not very effective for getting any eggs from them. And the other thing was that they competed with the cat for the cat food. People said,
what?
Didn't your cat hurt the chicken? Oh, no, of course not. The chickens hurt the cat. The chickens would go over and peck the cat on the head to get it to stop eating so they could get its food. So we had those Bantam hens, and then eventually we shut them up, which was the mistake. They were killed by dogs.
Oh.
And everything we got tended to be killed by neighborhood dogs.
Right.
And so we just finally, we couldn't, we didn't have the wit. We didn't know how to do a raised pen, or my husband wasn't handy, and I didn't have the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, animals are another level of work and care.
You don't have that. Did you have that problem with dogs coming and
killing?
Yeah, you did have.
I did. I had dogs killed my ducks and my geese, and I've had all kinds of animals. Hey, you know, the other thing I was thinking about that we have in common is we both killed possums before.
Mine, mine was a grim death, right? You'll have to admit it was very bad. I'm really embarrassed about it. I tried to drown it, and you know that thing about playing possum? Well, there's a reason for that. They apparently can close their noses up and be underwater for quite a while. Because when
crafty.
I finally, having felt like a murderer, there's the story's in my other book, but it's a fair funny story. I had to climb out on these things, and I took the trap out, and I put it down in the water, and I held it, and I did it at dusk so nobody would see me. and I was there I was, and suddenly the trap, the string on the trap broke. And I had to go down, and I thought I was going to drown myself. And I thought, this is going to be a story in the paper. You know, this woman is found with this trap, with this dead possum. This old woman is found floating in the Hudson River. But it didn't happen, and I got it back out, and I was so shaken by that time. I wasn't capable of dumping it out and putting it in a bag and doing anything. I just put it off next to the fence where nobody would see it. And I went out in the morning, and it was still alive.
Oh.
It wasn't happy, though. I mean, it wasn't healthy.
It was groggy.
It was pretty waterlogged, I think. And it probably had a bad cold, and it died finally. But it was really...
Lord.
But it was... I felt terrible. Did you do a better job?
Yeah, well, I used to... I mean, I used a shovel, and I decapitated it.
Did you?
Because... But, you know, I still was, like, worried it was going to come back to life, you know? There's, like, that moment. Because, like, we've seen too many horror movies.
They have a terrifying face.
You know what's weird now is that I have... Like, okay, so people are like, oh, my God, Novella kills animals. And I did, but I was really mad because it just killed these baby ducklings. So cute. And so it deserved to die, and I don't feel bad about that one. But now I have this opossum that lives in our chicken house. And he, like, I see him. He's like, I'm like, what are you doing? And one day I walked out to the chicken house because I noticed that someone was eating the eggs. And that's not grounds for murder at all, right? Eating eggs, whatever. So I lift up the nesting box, and it was sleeping right underneath the net, like totally, like curled up. And he opened up one eye, like, what? You know? And I was like, dang it. But I couldn't muster the rage. And so I actually did the same. I caught it in a trap, and then I drove it to the suburbs. And I was like, you know what? You're going to love it here. But, and I haven't seen him since. Sometimes it's good not to kill. That's what I learned. Okay, so I have a couple other questions to ask you. And one of these is, so we grow our own food, right? We've made this sort of political choice. I'm like drinking out of a mason jar. You know, we do all these things, right? We all do this right now because we're worried about global warming. And all these other things that are happening. But then I wonder, too, how much are these personal choices really going to make change? You know, like, I want to know what you think about this idea of, like, shouldn't I be going to, like, a global warming action committee meeting? Or, like, what should I be doing besides the personal stuff? Because I think, like, we can kind of get stuck on this idea, like, well, I'm not using plastic bags. But I know that the person next to me is, like, double bagging the plastic bags. So, like, they're, like, nullifying my action.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
What, you know, but is there, do you ever have a sense of, I mean, I know you've, anyway, let me know what I should do. What more?
What you should do is exactly what you're doing, which is make a noise about the importance of being careful about food and about paying attention to where your food comes from and setting a model for what other people can do. I mean, I teach and I still teach, so I feel like I know that there are at least 40 people every year who have their heads turned around, and I feel privileged to teach a course that means so much to people, because I know it means a lot to people. They tell me so when I see them many years later. Although I must tell you a very funny story about going to a conference in Washington a number of years ago, walking down the street and running into a former student, and she said to me, Joan, after we chatted a while, she said, Joan, you know, ever since I took your course, my husband and I are really trying to be very responsible, and, you know, we compost, and we recycle, and we don't waste anything, and we don't use too much energy or water or any of this. And she said, but my husband said to me the other day, well, when is the world going to end? And I said, well, I really don't know. But the truth is that it is going to, and we are in for very tough times as a society and as a world, as a global population. I mean, we have done great damage to the planet we live on. And as Bill McKibben wrote in his marvelous book, which you should go out and get right away if you haven't read it, called Earth with two A's, which is to say we don't live on the same planet anymore that we lived on, and we don't know how to run this one, and we better learn quickly. And I think that all of us who are trying to push local economies, local living, local eating, particularly, I mean, everyone who talks about what's coming talks about how hard eating is going to become because our food is shipped all over the world, and it is embedded with so much energy. And when energy gets expensive, food gets expensive, will get expensive. Mm-hmm. So I think that we all just have to teach in our own way and be political in our own ways, but also provide models. My students one time sent somebody out to my house just to check on whether I actually did what I said. So I know that it matters if you're teaching and if you're preaching, that you have to live by what you're preaching. And so I always try to. And I know that one of the things we gave to our class last fall, was a story from The Onion, which was hilarious, about, well, it's just one plastic bottle. I know my own plastic bottle won't make any difference, and it's done in The Onion's impeccable, beautiful style, and it's a very, very funny piece. And it doesn't, of course. I mean, my one bottle doesn't make a difference. But if I don't use them at all, it sets a model. And when my students come into class with plastic bottles of water, I look around and say, don't ever bring those into class, you know. And they learn, and they have to learn.
Right. So on that note of people coming to visit your garden, do you ever feel like you can't even harvest stuff? Because then you're like, this broccoli looks so good, I should eat it. And then you're like, wait a minute, I think someone's coming tomorrow. I need that to just be shellacked and just be there.
And do you ever give stuff away you would wish you'd kept for yourself?
Well, yeah, I gave this guy some turnips yesterday. But no, actually what I realized is, this is kind of a horrible realization, but I'm just going to tell you, that when I give people food, I think I get more out of it than they do. And it's sort of like this weird do-gooder thing where you're like, yeah, I just gave him those turnips. Those are going to rule. He's going to love those. And then I was all like so excited. And then I'm like, he might take those home and just throw them in the crisper and like totally forget about them. And I just realized that it doesn't really even matter. Like I get so much off of giving the food to other people. And it's just a weird thing. Yeah.
That's good.
So I don't regret it. No, I never regret it. I've never regretted it. Mm-mm.
I've given away too much. What I'm saying is sometimes I give away my last zucchini because they get so big so fast.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, oh, my God, they're going to catch up with me, and then there's no more.
Joan's last zucchini.
Oh, yeah. Well, I grow a zucchini called Clostata Romanescu, which is
that the
huge
one?
Yes.
Yeah, I love that.
And it gets
one.
Huge, and it's still tender, and you can leave it on the counter. I have one on the counter that's been there for 2 months now.
Wow.
Doesn't rot. It will still be usable.
Wow.
It's amazing. It's like a hard-shell zucchini.
Yeah, you give some zucchini recipes in this book,
yes,
too,
it's
right?
The only recipes in this book, right. It's the only recipes.
It's good to know. Hey, so you know who's talking right now is Obama. I think we're missing it. But
we
I was wondering what...
What are we missing?
I don't know. What are we missing? But well, I wanted to ask you, what do you think... What do you think about Michelle-grown food and stuff?
No, I think you should answer that.
All right. What do I think about Michelle? I think it's awesome because I can, you know, I can relax. I don't have to. Because, see, my thing is, like, I feel, and I'm sure you felt like this in 2001, or when did your garden start? When did you start growing food for yourself?
Seriously growing food for myself,
yeah.
Probably. Trying to do it year-round.
Yeah.
Probably 85.
Okay, so 85. So you were like a total wackadoo. And this is nothing to say. And I know that Michael Pollan has said that to you before, too. Like, that's like a crackpot thing, right? In 85, you're growing food. And I was like that, and I started in 98. You know, people were like, she's got chickens in her backyard, you know? And it was just too weird. And so now that Michelle has the bees and vegetables, I can just relax. It's fine. If the first lady is doing it, that's like all bets are off. I don't have to think that I'm fringe at all. I can totally just point to her and be like, she's doing it. So it's actually really relaxing.
I think that you probably, which is odd because I think of you as so incredibly more courageous than I would never have moved into that district in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
Yeah, but
I would not
poor.
Have that nerve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
No, but I've lived in poor parts of Manhattan, but not that poor. Not,
yeah?
Yeah.
Really?
I'd never lived any place that felt quite as dangerous as you make that seem. Was
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I don't know about Manhattan. Manhattan doesn't sound dangerous. It's
not dangerous anymore, but it was. There were times when I was young. Yeah, you were never to go to Central Park, for instance. Never go to Central Park.
Well, the deal was I moved here from Seattle where I rented a three-story house for $1,200 a month and, you know, had like eight roommates and it was great. And then I moved here and it was like for $1,200 I could get a two-bedroom apartment where I would have a roommate living in the other, you know. So it was just, it's an economic thing. I mean, it's expensive in the Bay Area. And so there were no other neighborhoods where we could afford to live. So in some ways it was a class issue, you know. It's not like I could just say, oh, I want to live in a safe neighborhood. It was like, I need to live somewhere.
But you had the nerve to do it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't feel like I deserve an award for that because, you know, people live in that neighborhood. They grew up in that neighborhood, you know. And I don't know. I just, yeah, it's a complicated thing. But, yeah. But, I mean, you know, and also the other thing is living in that neighborhood where there's prostitutes and gunfire. When I have two pigs, no one's going to say anything. You know what I'm saying? You're like, what?
It's
you know?
True. I do think the pigs would have been a problem for me, actually, living next to them. I really do. The smell would have gotten me.
The smell
I'm
was
I'm surprised
out
that people did not
Well, it really wasn't okay. It really wasn't okay. I have goats now, and they don't really smell that much. Like, not like the pigs. But, you know, what it used to be like when we would get, you know, like the neighbor, we'd get together and the neighbors would be chatting about our various weird projects. It would be like, okay, she has pigs, he's dealing drugs, she's a prostitute. I mean, it was just like, we would all just like be like, well, we're not going to call the police on each other, you know? So, and that was kind of how it would work out, you know, like that was a happy, happy time in our neighborhood. And it's not the same anymore, really.
Really?
In fact, I'm really worried. I'm worried about the goat. I'm worried that eventually...
Did the warehouse across the way get gentrified?
The warehouse is actually just a big pot-growing operation now. So, yes, it's gentrified.
You mean they have lights inside and it's indoor pot-growing?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah. There's no speakeasy anymore. And the monks bought the house next door and fixed it up. So it looks great. It looks beautiful. The monastery is doing really well. But a lot of the other people have moved away from the neighborhood. You know, Bobby's
the guy
gone.
That lived in the car.
Yeah.
He's gone.
I see him. I see him every once in a while on the street and we chat. And but it's definitely, yeah, it's changed. But, you know, and then the recession happened. So things are kind of like back to the sort of same weird level, but not much gunfire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite crop?
My favorite
vegetable
crop?
Yes. Vegetable, not
Joan,
animal.
Don't make me choose one.
Well, there must be something that you enjoy growing.
I mean, the things that I honestly love growing the most are trees. I love growing fruit trees. I love growing apples, especially because I've learned how to graft over the years. And so I have this, like, crazy tree that's got, like, a million varieties on it. So many that I'm like, which one is that?
You learned to graft?
That? Did you?
Oh, yeah. That's what I always wanted to do. Oh. That's great.
I just went to the Scion Exchange, you know. There's the California rare fruit growers have this, like, thing where they bring it's basically chunks of DNA of trees that they, you know, it's usually...
It's like a twig.
It's a twig piece. And then you graft it on, you attach it to your tree. And then sometimes it, if you do it correctly, it'll grow and make that variety on that tree. I know it's like sci-fi. There's people in the audience that are like, she made that up. No, it's true. And that's what I love, right? That's like so cool and magical that you can do this. And it's just like, and I go to the Scion Exchange and I see everyone else is having the same experience at the Scion Exchange, which is like pure fear. Like, I gotta get everything that I can, you know? And so, you know, because they have these things in baggies and you're all like nudging each other trying to get to the, you know, King David apple or whatever it is, you know? But, and then what I realized, because I've been doing it for a while now, is like, I'm just cool, calm, collected. I walk in, because I have too many, you know, there have been times when I've taken too much of this
stuff
home.
So how many different Scions do you put on the same trunk? That same tree.
I mean, no, now it's like, you know, you can't do anymore, you know. I think the one I have has like, it only has seven on there. It could have more. It could totally have more. But I bought rootstock and I'm grafting onto these little trees, potted trees. Because my dream is to have an orchard. My dream, because the thing is like annual crops, I mean, I can't believe it's so much work. You're like planting them, you're watering them, they grow, then you'd harvest them and they're gone, you know. But the apples and the orchard trees, you know, those just keep coming back every year. It's like a gift.
I think you have a better climate here for that than I have because I don't have, I love the fruit I get. I have an Asian pear, which is fabulous. Mm. And I have an apple, which I don't spray. So the apples are really pretty bad. Only a mother can love, you know.
You get the, like, the moths or something in there?
Yeah, whatever it is, coddling moths, I'm sure, yes. Mm. And I've tried the red apples hanging and the white things hanging and all
the
stuff. No, it didn't work.
Dang.
And so I always have, you know, punky-looking apples, but I eat them. They taste great.
Oh, yeah.
And my peach tree started getting mold. That is, just as the peaches ripened, they got moldy. And so I consider fruit growers, as I think I say at some point in my book, I consider people who grow fruit for us to be the most generous, wonderful people in the world who work really hard to get those cherries. I cannot believe that people actually grow cherries.
I know, harvesting them.
Harvesting cherries and getting them with the away from the birds.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. We should all be just so grateful. And when I see people treat it as if it's like, you know, here's a bowl of fruit sitting here. If it rots, it rots. You know, it's really not... You know, fruit is really precious.
Yeah, that's not okay.
No, it's not okay at all.
What's your favorite vegetable? Crop.
Crop? Well, probably asparagus in some ways.
Yeah.
Probably asparagus and blueberries. I mean, I grow that kind of fruit, small fruit.
Yeah. Hey, wait, speaking of asparagus, will you read this little... We didn't set this up, you guys. This is not a setup. But will you read this section about where you talk about asparagus? Just the part where, like, you've had a flood, you're talking about growing asparagus, starting right there.
Oh, okay. This is after my, like, ninth attempt, and I finally think I had it. And so, if nature is willing, I hope that I might have one day, short of my 90s, an actual bed of asparagus. Then again, I might not. Even if I do finally manage to produce some edible spears, however, you're not likely to get steamed asparagus if you come to eat here. That's because I learned years ago what has become my default way of cooking this rare vegetable. Lay the spear side by side on a cutting board, and then holding the knife flat on a sharp diagonal to the board, slice them into inch-long pieces. Sauté these for a minute or two in olive, or my new discovery, grapeseed oil, salting lightly as you remove them from the stove and serve. Better than popcorn and intensely green in taste and color. Want me to go on? If you're alert, you've probably assumed you know why, in this era when everything flies to us from everywhere in every season, there seems to be a more recognized season for asparagus than there is for most other vegetables. You might think the reason why there's a week or two in spring when everyone is saying to everyone else, the asparagus is in, is that asparagus, being a shoot, shoots up only in spring. You're partially right, but it's a bit more complicated than that. As this novice asparagus grower learned the hard way, asparagus will continue to send up shoots for some time through the growing season, producing a thickening clump of stalks. But if you cut the emerging shoots beyond some as yet to me indeterminable time, you will seriously weaken the plant for future production. Asparagus sends those shoots up for a reason, after all, to make ferns that can exploit the photosynthetic energy of the sun to keep itself growing. And like the rest of what nature does, you'd better not assume for too long that what she's putting out there is all just for you.
I love that. I just planted asparagus after I bought the lot. I was like, honey, I'm getting on the website and I'm buying asparagus.
Yeah.
Because
I don't know
if you guys know, it takes like 3 years before your crowns will develop.
If you're as cheap as I am, as I used to be, I'm not anymore. I'm too old to be that cheap.
Right.
I think there's a $2 difference between the one-year crown and the three-year crowns when you buy them. And I said, okay, Joan, you're getting too old to make those distinctions. Three-year crown. It really makes them much bigger.
I got little crowns.
No, don't do that.
But
no.
I'm still a little bit young. A little bit young.
Yes, you're young enough to wait.
I can wait. And I also got some seeds, too.
If I can interrupt for just a moment, I wanted to remind the audience we are going to have a Q&A in just another minute or two, and we have a central microphone there, so you can queue up if you have a question, and then we'll probably go till about 5 or 10 after 7. Okay.
Yeah. I wanted to get into like a whole another ball of wax. We're growing asparagus, we're like canning tomatoes, we're like doing all these things. We're ladies. I'm wondering, like, have you thought about this idea, and I know you have, that's what I'm asking you, but just for the wisdom of sometimes, you know, when I'm on my, I don't know, like my 50th quart jar of tomatoes, I get kind of cranky. And then, like, Bill wanders in, and he's like, I don't know, he's been working on a car or something. And he's like, we need more tomatoes, you know? And I'm like, well, you can these then, you know, because it's like you're hot, sweaty. What about this idea of, you know, why are we the ones that are growing the food? The ladies.
Oh, well, that's a whole other thing, isn't it?
I know it is.
Yeah. And my husband loved the garden. He loved walking in the garden and pointing out the things that needed doing.
That's what Bill does.
Making sure it was on my list. It wasn't on his, you know. But he thought that was a good thing to do.
What's up with that?
And, I know. It's funny. I know men who do garden. Their wives don't. Maybe it's a competition thing. Maybe if the women do it, the guys don't. Maybe if we just stopped.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to stop because I don't have a guy.
Right.
So,
no, right.
You know.
I'm too much of a control freak. Plus, you think my garden's squalid. If Bill was in control, it would be a disaster. It would be a total disaster.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I used to think maybe it was only Alan, but I have one theory about it. I believe that men are more controlling than women just by temperament. You know, they like to control things. And, sorry, for those of you who are... I used to talk in my class about women's and men's traits, and I knew, because in nutrition there are no men. You know, I'm in the classroom and there are two guys out there, so I'd say something about something, and I'd say, no, Paul, I don't think of you as a man. It's okay. Don't worry about that.
Just gender roles, we're sort of expected to, you know, do the cleaning and the vegetable production.
I really do believe this. You really have to let nature be in charge. You have to do it when it's time to do it. Mm-hmm. It's not like you can say, well, I'm not feeling like cleaning up that mess today. I mean, I'm not feeling like picking those tomatoes today. I'll wait till tomorrow, and tomorrow they'll be rotten.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not feeling like canning them, and the flies are swarming around, you know, and you have to.
Yep.
Alan did not want to be controlled by anything.
Oh.
And that included nature. And I think you have to be willing to yield. I mean, I think we all have to be. That's my larger lesson, but I think we all have to be willing to yield to nature. And she is in charge.
Right.
You know, she really is.
Right.
And we are, you know, as someone once said, you know, if we win the war, our war on nature, goodbye.
Right.
That's us. So I think that's part of it. I think there's a sense in which the need to yield is harder for men.
Mm.
But that may be, that's just my present thought.
Mm-hmm.
I may change my mind tomorrow.
It's a pretty good one. I think you're right, because you kind of have to do it. You're like, well, I can't just not do this.
Right.
I feel compelled. Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Wow.
I thought we were supposed to start taking questions. Aren't we supposed to start
taking questions? Oh, does anyone have a question?
Anybody have a question?
Like,
What's your favorite seed company?
If I just can remind you to speak directly into the microphone so the tape will pick it up. Thank you.
There's like a little switch on it.
Hi. I am going to do what Novella's doing in my house in San Francisco, and I've got probably a tenth of an acre, and I'm getting roommates that are all going to help, and I actually advertised it that way. What would you recommend that we do first?
Oh, is that for me or Joan? Oh, okay. Well, I'll say what I'm going to say, and then we're going to ask Joan because she's the expert. I would say you need to amend the soil. The other day I was walking by and I saw this church had prepped the soil and had planted into the saddest dust. They planted into dust, and I was like, nothing's going to grow. You know, that's going to be really sad. And I know, how do I know? Because I've done that when I first started. You know, everyone's like, oh, you had hippie parents. They showed you how the way. No, they didn't. I had to learn the hard way. And that is basically the only thing you have to do is bring in some really good composted poo from some animal. And it's just going to be magic. And, like, lay it on thick and double dig and make prep beds and that kind of. What would you say?
Well, the first thing is look at the sun patterns. I mean, look at it, follow the sun, watch where the sun goes and try to get the most sun. And the second thing is, what's there now? A lawn? Grass?
A gentle hillside facing south with bushes and things like that.
We have to repeat it. He has a south-facing hill, slight.
That's good.
Incline, that is good. That sounds like heaven. And then some bushes. What are they, native plants, or can you just whack them? Just whack them. Yeah, just whack them.
Well, I guess what I would say is that I'm a great believer in not digging too much at the beginning, and that if you have any kind of stuff growing that can just be cut back, and you can mulch it with cardboard or something like that and cover it with wood chips or something that makes it aesthetic, you should kill out what's there without digging it up, because most people peel off the lawn, which is all the fertility in the soil. Mm. And the best thing is to let it rot into the soil and dig holes through it. If you want to garden the first year, you can actually dig a hole right through it and then amend that hole. You don't have to amend the whole thing. I mean, that's the way to start. And if you're going to do something like in a row and you want to sow seeds, then just dig up that part. But mulch everything down so that you reduce the weeding phenomenally. But if you dig everything up, every piece of crabgrass, every piece of, what's the kind you have here?
Bermuda grass.
Everything's going to come up.
Yeah.
And that the best thing is not to do that.
Yeah. What do you use for mulch, like wood chips?
Cardboard.
Oh, cardboard. Okay.
Like, you know,
yeah.
beer cartons.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you need to, you can take old nails and hold them down that way, and then put wood chips over it or anything you can get that looks good. You can buy mulch at the store, but that's expensive. Mm-hmm. Usually communities have wood chips available.
Yeah, they'll come and drop a load for you. The other thing, too, is to decide what you would eat, you know, because a lot of people are like, cool, gardening. I hate kale, but I think I'm going to try to grow it because then maybe I'll like it. And that doesn't really work, you know. So grow stuff, but, you know, take a little. It's fun, too. It's like a planning meeting where you guys, like, order your seeds and stuff and you talk about what you want to get. So, yeah.
You know how San Francisco encourages neighborhood gardens, like at the Presidio and in the Richmond? That'd be some type of land use easement that the city is encouraging. Maybe you'd want to find out what type of ordinance so that this would be encouraged more and would be invoked more often, this ethos.
What, in Oakland, you mean?
Or? I know San Francisco has a couple of public gardens.
Yeah. We have a lot of, there's a lot of public gardens, like community gardens in Oakland. The problem is, sadly, the funding, you know, there's no money. And so they don't really want to, you know, throw any money at programs like that.
Before you go on, I can actually add to that. The planning meeting on February 10th is having a meeting at 1:30. February 17th at 1:30 to talk about urban zoning for agriculture, if you're interested. Thank you.
This is perhaps more of a comment than a question, but I was reading Joan's article on women and food back in 1985, and you're talking about a home economics professor who was just sort of terrified that her entire department was about to be shut down. And I was sort of reflecting on that back in the 1980s, in a consumer society in which we outsourced everything. We outsourced cooking and cleaning and raising our children, that home economics was pretty much a dying art. And it feels to me as though the homesteading movement that is coming into being at this point is sort of a reclaiming of the home economics, but in a meaningful way, where we actually grow the food and then we cook the food, et cetera.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Home economics, the home economics profession was co-opted, much the way the nutrition profession has been co-opted, in my view. It became a way of selling things. It really did. I mean, home economics, I one time gave a talk to a bunch of home economists, and I said, what you should really be is home economists. Mm. You're not. You know, you're not figuring out how to make the home an economical place and so forth. Anyway, yeah.
Well, this is very exciting to hear both of you. A few of us came from Sausalito because we are getting approval to do this huge community garden, almost an acre.
No way.
And
great.
People
cool.
are thrilled. They're absolutely thrilled. And we have a big field. And so I'm trying to think of a question.
that's okay.
Maybe we're going to build soil first. But I think what surprised me the most, and probably everyone else, is that people want to do communal gardening. Mm-hmm. Most community gardens, people have private little plots. But we thought, well, we're going to try and push some permaculture ideas on them, see how that goes, and everyone's thrilled.
Cool.
And they all want to work together. And I'm going, have you guys ever worked with a group trying to do a vegetable garden? They'll go, no.
Right.
So it's going to be a new experience. And so I'm just wondering if you have any advice for us.
That's really interesting. I had a friend that used to do that style. He called it Cuban, not to be a communist. But and what they would do is they'd be like, okay, we don't have that much space, but we all want to grow corn. And so we're going to just grow a bunch of corn, and then everyone gets corn. And they would harvest it, share the duties, and then split up the crop that way. And I'm totally an American. I was like, oh, hell no. I wouldn't do that. Mm-mm. Because I'm a control freak. I want to know that I grew that one bit. And actually, I went to Venezuela to do some other project that had nothing to do with food. And I happened to go to their urban agriculture areas. And I was like, wow, so you guys are growing this food communally. And they're like, well, kind of. And what it was is, everyone was in charge of a different part of the garden. So there's that sense of, that's mine. But then the harvest was shared. And I think that is a really good model. Because then everyone feels like you have like, because otherwise if you don't, you know, maybe you're not going to show up. You're like, oh, I'm going to go do something else. And everyone else can plant the corn. But then your little plot is going to look pretty bad if you didn't plant the corn, you know. So there's some kind of personal responsibility, not to get all Rush Limbaugh on you. But, you know, you need to have that a little bit, you know. And so that's what I would say. Have you ever done any kind of communal?
No, it's interesting. The garden in Nyack, north of me, they have a community garden.
Yeah.
And what they do, our community garden, everyone has their own little plot. And they keep it. It's the same plot, because otherwise people say, well, if you improve your soil and really work to improve your soil, you don't want to give it up the next year to
right.
someone and start over. But in Nyack, they plow the whole thing up. And then people make claims on a part of it. So they don't garden communally, but they do share the space, and it's redivided up every year, and it's fertilized generally every year. And so and I think it works very well. I think I would like to make a general comment here about this, because I love what you're saying, and I've been in Cuba and I've seen the Cuban gardens too, and I want to say we're very, very bad at cooperating in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just don't. I went and taught in Japan. The students love to do common projects. They work together. They love to work together. I came back. I said to my students, okay, we're going to lose if we don't learn. They're going to beat us. So let's learn to do common projects. Well, you know, I'm not going to get an A if this. I don't want to take a chance of this person not doing good work. I don't want to risk my grade. It's very disturbing, and I would really encourage all of us to figure ways when we have a chance, like you're talking about, to see if there are ways of kind of getting that herding instinct a little back again and saying maybe we ought to try to work this out as a group and make it work as a group. Because we just don't do it well, and we're going to need to live in communities and communally and to share things and learn to do those things again, and we've really been shoved apart from them.
I think we're at that point where we'll just take one final question before we have our closing.
Thank you both for being here tonight. My husband and I just bought a house up in the hills because there's a recession and we can afford to live in the hills now. Mm. And we have a tiny garden, and it's totally shaded by, I'm pretty sure, non-native trees. And there's a little creek running down the side, which is kind of cool, but more than half of the yard is cobbled over. And so I'm thinking, what is the highest use I can put to this little piece of ground that's about twice the size of the house? Can I grow stuff on it, or is the best use that it can be put to let it revert to some more natural state? And I'm curious as to your thoughts on that, please.
You go first, Joan.
What?
You go first.
No, you go first.
No. I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, okay. All right. So she has a small amount of land, but it's kind of shady. I mean, I instantly am like, chickens. You know, chickens. But that's my own kind of hang up, that I always want to have animals everywhere, or rabbits. I don't know if you eat meat, but so I would do that. And then, you know, the other thing is that what is shocking to me is how much you can grow on a little amount of space. Because sometimes we play this game. What if I just lived in this apartment? What if I didn't have actually access to this big amount of space? And so I started growing food in buckets and lining it on the outside of my windowsill. It looks so nice. It's super. It's not tacky at all. No, it's very squalid. But then what happens is, I mean, I just had a salad from one of the buckets today, and it was a huge amount of salad, and I had one yesterday, and I had one the day before. So you can grow so much food in a little amount of space. So I would just pick the sunniest part of it, amend the soil, and start growing some stuff in buckets. No, something like that. You'd be surprised if you want to grow something, how little space you can actually get a lot of food from. That's what I would say. What would you share?
Well, I have one crop which I'm insanely fond of, which is sweet potatoes, which is very, very productive, very long-lasting. You can cure them and keep them a year. This contrary to what you're told all the time about how they don't keep. If you cure them, you can do it. And you can read my first book, and it tells you how to cure sweet potatoes. But they are... They actually transformed a bed. I had... When my garden was redone, Dave, who helped me do it, was spreading the topsoil, and then the Stone Barns people came and they did the beds, and we had Stone Barns compost, and then I had 20 more feet, and which we couldn't do until we had some walls to build. So when we got to this 20 feet, Dave said, "What are you going to do here?" And I said, "Well, we're going to have two more beds on each side." He said, "No, you're not." I said, "Yes, I am, Dave." He said, "No, I have no topsoil left." So we had no topsoil left. So what I had was this unbelievable stuff somebody came with a pickaxe, I mean with an axe, and actually axed the soil up for me because it was so hard. It just turned into rock. So I thought, what am I going to plant in these beds? It makes my garden look hideous to have these empty beds. You know, a gardener can't have just an empty, hideous-looking bed sitting there, right?
Not when people are coming over.
So I thought, well, sweet potatoes have proved to me they'll grow almost anywhere. So I'm going to make little fertilized holes for the sweet potaetos and slips when they come in, and you put them in. And I did that. And then I harvested them in October, and I had 40 pounds of sweet potatoes and out of this one bed, and it had totally transformed the soil. Now, I went around asking people. I said, "Have you ever heard of this?" And one guy, a European farmer who's a soil biologist, told me that when you get these root crops with these big bulging roots and these little fine roots, they attract these soil organisms that glue the soil together, and they change the texture of the soil. Nobody else seems to know that except me, and I'm planting sweet potatoes in all the lousy beds.
Wow.
But it's a wonderful, wonderful crop, and I recommend it.
Wow. Okay. There you go.
Well, I think with that note, we'll thank our speakers again, Novella Carpenter and Joan Gusseau. And I also want to thank our audience here as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.